third of five sessions dealing with the strategy of warfare of the United States entitled Low Intensity Conflict. And I chose a controversial title, which I'll come back to in a minute. Just a couple of reminders. The bookstore asked us to remind you that they ordered some copies of different resource people's books, including mine. The specific topic that we're dealing in these five sessions, The War Against the Poor, is in this book with that title. And then another book called The Politics of Compassion, which deals with issues of U.S. policy in relation to hunger, the arms race, and U.S. policy in Central America. And there's a chapter in there on hope. And I have a feeling for those of you who are able to be here over the four or five sessions, that's one of the things that we need to talk about at some point is hope, because this is very, for me at least, it's very difficult material to deal with, or difficult issues to deal with. I wanted to begin with a couple of quotes that I think will illustrate that I unfortunately didn't choose the title flippantly, Why U.S.-Backed Governments Murder Priests. Unfortunately, there are many U.S.-backed governments that murder priests, and the most recent example of a quite large number of examples was the murder of the Jesuit priests in El Salvador. I mentioned earlier that I knew two of those priests that were murdered in El Salvador. And I wanted to start out with a quotation from an open letter that was sent to Christians in the United States from the Latin American Council of Churches immediately following the murder of the Jesuits. This is just an excerpt. It says, how long will Christians and people of the United States have to contemplate the incongruity of its government as it supports with over $1 million a day another government that represses, kills bishops, religious workers, children, men and women, violates human rights, closes itself to dialogue, and obstructs the pastoral task of the churches? How long? In the name of God of justice, in the name of Jesus Christ, Prince of Peace, in the name of the Spirit of all truth, stop now. The other quotation I wanted to begin with is an excerpt from the human rights organization America's Watch. It's a very, very highly respected human rights organization. And how many, I'd be interested, how many of you are Lutheran? Quite a number of us are Lutheran. Some of you may be familiar with the name Medardo Gomez, who's the Lutheran bishop in El Salvador. Medardo Gomez would be dead today, except he happened to be out of his church on the same day the Jesuits were murdered. Because the same day the Jesuits were murdered, the Lutheran church in El Salvador was taken over. But this is a quote from America's Watch report following the murder of the Jesuits. It says, the government's hostility towards church and relief organizations was particularly pronounced. In the period November 13th through December 14th, there were 54 searches of 40 different church facilities and homes of church workers by Salvadoran military and security forces. Dozens of church workers received death threats and fled the country under government order government order or death threat. Dozens more were jailed and abused in detention, and numerous church facilities were ransacked. The symbolic significance of the army's murder of the country's leading academic and religious figures, the Jesuits, cannot be overstated. The deaths signal that once again no one is safe from army and death squad violence. The Bush administration has taken the position that the Jesuit murders were a dramatic departure from Salvadoran army policy. In our view, the murders were entirely in keeping with Salvador's 10-year civil war. Those responsible for almost every other instance of egregious abuse against Salvadoran citizens still enjoy absolute immunity. That's a quote from the America's Watch report. Now, in a few minutes, I'm going to go into my understanding of why the Jesuits were murdered in this particular case in El Salvador, what the U.S. role is in creating conditions and an ideological climate in which those kinds of abuses take place. But first, I wanted to invite you again to turn to a person next to you, and we'll probably spend about 5 minutes in these small groups, just again, turn to one person next to you. And I want you to reflect upon two questions. The first question is, what does the Bible say about why people are poor? What does the Bible say about why people are poor and about poverty? And second, why was Jesus crucified? Why was Jesus crucified? Those two questions. So spend 5 minutes, and then we'll have, again, in a brainstorm format, we'll come back and report. Okay, I think I'll ask you to pull back together. I hate to cut off lively discussion, but we'll probably have some lively discussion coming up too in a little while. Very quickly, again, the same kind of format that we've been using, more of a just a brainstorm, throwing ideas out. What kinds of things did you come up with? What kinds of things does the Bible say about why people are poor?
Doesn't seem to say that it's as punishment.
Okay, not as punishment.
Well, I thought there's a strand in there, isn't there?
That says, if you're poor, it's because you're punished?
There's a strand.
Okay, so you see a strand in there. Others?
Because the rich are oppressed.
Yeah, because the rich are oppressed.
Okay, because poverty is a result of the oppression of the rich. That certainly would be consistent with much of the prophetic tradition.
Does it actually say that, though? Where does it say that in the Bible?
Amos,
Hosea,
Micah,
Jeremiah.
Any of the prophets. And much of Jesus. Jesus.
Mary, you didn't even know.
Mary. That certainly is a major strand, I would say. It's not the only strand, but it certainly is a major piece. Others?
Well, and in Deuteronomy and Exodus, it gives rules of how the land is to be returned to the people that lose the land. So it's like saying, this is going to happen. This is what you do.
I talk in the Politics of Compassion about, I go through some stuff on biblical economics, and one of those pieces is to talk about how the biblical writers saw that it was necessary to break cycles of wealth and poverty, and Jubilee and the sabbatical provisions and others were part of that. What else?
I was just wondering if there is a strand at all about poverty being a punishment. The only things I can think of is in the communal sense, that if the whole community has gone against God's will, then they are punished in some ways that may result in punishment. Mm-hmm. But that, in that case, that would be an entire nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were, and again, in Deuteronomy, there were things, if you do these things, mm-hmm. then you won't have poverty among you. There's even mm-hmm. those kinds of things as well, which is a little bit of a twist on that. Mm-hmm. And I think I heard it in one or more groups. Of course, there's the classic statement that the poor will always be with you, mm-hmm. and how that gets interpreted and used. Mm-hmm. Okay, how about the other question? Why was Jesus crucified?
Because he threatened the powers that were in existence at the time by his...
Who did he threaten?
He threatened the heads of the Jewish nation, the priests and the head guys, who were the ones...
Okay, so religious leaders.
The religious leaders, and they were dishing out the rules of how people should be, and then he came and said that there was this whole other way you could live, and it was threatening to their power, and they had to get rid of him.
But they didn't crucify. Roman government.
It just adds to that as well as the government.
It depends on which gospel you read.
So Rome wasn't pleased with Jesus either. So we can, religious authorities in Rome certainly weren't pleased. Anybody else? Why
where
Jesus is,
where
was
does,
crucified?
Where does the classic theory of atonement then of Paul fit in here?
We'll save that for another class. And someone who might know an answer.
Aren't those how answers rather than why questions? Why answers? The question is, why did Christ die? It was because he was prophesied to die. And why was he prophesied to die? And it was to fulfill God's plan to show him that you love this. That would be my view of the why.
Okay, I would say that's another way of answering the why question, but I would say these are answers to why questions too.
Well, one's a purpose, why, from a functional standpoint, what purpose did it serve, and the other why is, what's the causality?
What's the reason, what led, what were the things that led?
I mean, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I think it's a very, very important question, and it's a question that I'm always astounded at how little it gets asked, among Christians particularly, even during Easter time. We leap pretty quickly to the resurrection. And one of the things, John Sobrino, which is one of the Jesuit priests who survived in El Salvador because he was out of the country when his brothers were murdered, he's written a book called Christology at the Crossroads. And one of the things he says in this book is that we, as Christians, those of us who are Christian, we can't understand the meaning of our faith unless we understand the meaning of Jesus' faith. In other words, that Jesus wrestled with what it meant to be faithful. And we have a lot of that. We have Jesus in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights before he gives his first sermon in Luke, which is the sermon about the Spirit of the Lord is upon me to preach good news to the poor, liberation to the oppressed, etc. So it's a very important question to ask, I think, is why? Who did Jesus alienate and why? Because as we read the scriptures, if we're not alienated by some of Jesus' message, then we're probably not hearing it correctly. Yeah,
I just had to add that it wasn't just Jesus who was threatening the powers of be, but it was just a real person's revolution that was begun, and that was the collective mass was what was very threatening.
Jesus spent a lot of time among the poor, and there certainly was, and this is a very critical point in this, and it's one of the more cynical aspects of this warfare strategy that we've been talking about, some of us now, for a couple of sessions, is that hope is considered the enemy by powerful people and groups. Let me just encourage you, if you haven't seen it, another question I could have asked, I'm not going to ask it in the interest of time, is the question, why was Archbishop Romero killed? And if you haven't seen it, I suggest that you do see the film Romero. How many have seen it? Just by quite a number, about almost a third or third to a half. It's a very powerful description of what life is like and continues to be like in this U.S.-backed society and country El Salvador.
We have it here, Jack.
Oh, you do? Oh, that would be. We should schedule that sometime. I would. Very powerful. Okay, I want to give a little bit of background and then make a more direct link to the persecution of the church directly to U.S. policy. But in order to do that, I want to give a little background, and then I'm going to have us get into small groups for more than 5 minutes. Okay. The background that I want to share is a little bit, first of all, on kind of the way theology functioned and continues to function, by and large, in many parts of the world, but specific to Central and Latin America. And that theology, which was the dominant theology for a long time, and in some degree maybe still is, was what I would call, and I describe in this book, The Politics of Compassion, as a colonial theology. At the same time that conquerors were coming and pillaging gold and silver and enslaving people, they did that hand in hand with a church that had a specific kind of theology. Now, I'm not going to go into great detail on the theology, but I just want to mention three key characteristics of that theology. One aspect of it was that poverty was God's will, that if you were poor, God wanted you to be poor. if you're rich, God wants you to be rich. It's wonderful, wonderful message for the rich. A second piece of that theology was that you obey authority. You obey church authority and you obey state authority. And a third part of the message was that if you accept your lot in life, particularly if you're poor, if you do obey authority, then when you die, you go to heaven, and that's where your reward will be, that the streets of heaven are paved with gold. Now, we don't have time to talk about this, but I would say that theology is alive and well in much of what passes for theology within our own churches, and it's still alive and well in Central and Latin America. And there was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of that theology, which is part of the spiritual, emotional oppression of huge segments of the populations in Central and Latin America. Now, that's background on that. But that's not the only theology. And what's happened throughout the years, and particularly in the last about 25 or 30 years, has been the introduction of what has been called liberation theology. And I just want to share with you very briefly a few aspects of what liberation theology is, because it has some very different assumptions. Liberation theology, of which the Jesuit priests were strong supporters, of which Romero, his whole faith, I think, was transformed by the people as he came to see the people living out their faith in response to the kind of theology I'm going to describe. It's a very strong current within what's happening. And I don't think we can understand any of the religious or political changes or social turmoil in Central America without understanding this conflict between these theologies, the colonial theology and this liberation theology. But just a couple of aspects, very briefly. First, liberation theology stresses the dignity of each human person. That may not sound very important, but when you've been living in slave-like conditions, and that's part of what you've inherited over centuries, you tend to internalize a lot of your oppression, and you lose a sense of dignity. Liberation theology says, by virtue of being a creature of God, you have dignity. And that is a very powerful message. A second kind of thing that liberation theology gives testimony to is the fact that sin is not just individual, that there are sinful social structures. That if 2% of the people, as in Guatemala, own or control 80% of the land, that is a situation of structural sin, because the landless see their children die before the age of 5. Those kind of structures don't allow people to live in dignified circumstances. So they introduce the idea of institutionalized violence. Violence isn't just picking up a gun. You can live in a violent society by virtue of the way that it's structured. A third kind of piece to think about with liberation theology is its method, the method under which theology happens, thinking about God in the world. And the method of liberation theology links three things, and think about it as a circle, an ongoing, these three things are constantly informing each other. The first is social analysis, that in order to be responsible people of faith, liberation theology says, and even in order to understand the Bible, we have to understand something about the society in which the Bible was written, and we have to understand our own society. We have to look at questions like, why are people hungry? Why do 2% of the people own the land? What is the impact of the present trading relationships between the dominant countries and poor countries? Those are questions essential to be probed as part of a framework in which to probe the meaning of faith. The second aspect, or second piece of this circle, is biblical reflection in light of that social analysis, in light of an understanding of why people are poor, why people are hungry. Then Scripture can be open to us in new kinds of ways. And the third component in this ongoing circle, again, is action. That faith isn't something that you study, that you talk about, that you write books about, that you have interesting conversations about. It's something that informs your life and your life choices. You live it out. Okay, so that's a central feature of this liberation theology, which lends itself and has lended itself very nicely to poor people in their communities learning about their situation. They can start with the question, why don't we have a school? Okay? And then they can start thinking about why they don't have a school and start analyzing why they don't have a school. And then they can start thinking about scriptures and who was Jesus. And then they take action. They go and they confront the local powers that be and say, we want a school. The Constitution says we have a right to a school. Why don't we have a school? It encourages that kind of active participation in life. It generates hope. It gives that sense of dignity again. Just the method itself is very important. Another thing that liberation theology does is it, excuse the pun, it resurrects Jesus. It gives Jesus a different kind of meaning. The traditional view of Jesus in Latin America is kind of as a passive victim. Walk into almost any church and Jesus is nailed on a cross. You go into our churches and Jesus is off the cross and there's a stress on the resurrection. It's very common in Central and Latin America within the colonial theology that Jesus is a victim on a cross. What liberation theology has done is it says Jesus was crucified as a consequence of his life and his faith that he lived out to its ultimate consequence. And that's what we're called to do if we want to be followers of Jesus. So it gives Jesus a much more active, hopeful, the example. People saw Jesus in Romero. And people see that Romero has been resurrected in a similar way that Jesus was. That the spirit of Romero continues to live on. Okay. Another feature of liberation theology that's more directed at people like us is liberation theology, by the way, is not theology for the poor. It's theology. And it has a claim on us. It says neutrality is impossible. That when we try to escape involvement in these kinds of issues by saying, oh, it's too complicated, I don't want to take a stand because I might make the wrong choice. In not choosing, we make choices. Liberation theology points out we have to be actively involved or we are already involved. Basically on the side of what is. And then another basic feature of liberation theology was a preferential or preferred option for the poor. Not to the exclusion that God doesn't care about the rich, but saying that the church's vocation is to take oppression seriously and to try to overcome it. Okay? Now, one other piece of background. And this background, by the way, is getting me towards the end of my presentation, so don't think this is leading into a huge presentation. But this is all essential background for the question, why do U.S.-backed governments kill priests? And not just priests, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of lay workers. And the other little background piece I want to share is just a few words about the ideology of a national security state. Now, you can be the judge of whether this country is a national security state. I have my own opinions about that. But many countries in Central and Latin America that receive major backing from the United States are national security states. And I was trying to just identify three or four different characteristics of a national security state. And I'm just going to name them for you. One of them is that they tend to, the governments and the militaries within them tend to view their situation as part of a grand struggle between international communism and capitalism, state capitalism, we could say. But they're part of this grand struggle in which international communists are trying to take control of everything. That's part of the ideology of the national security state. A second piece of it is that capital accumulation, or the wealth of elites, must be protected, expanded, preserved at all costs, because that's the key to development and freedom. That you have to have this huge, this even small group of incredibly wealthy elites, because it's their capital that is the key to freedom for all of us. That's part of the national security state, and that the state's job is to preserve the power of these rich elites. A third feature of the national security state is that there are enemies of freedom, freedom in quotes, lurking everywhere. Where? They're external, they're internal. The external ones are linked to international communism. The internal ones are either communists themselves or they're dupes of communism. But they're everywhere, and they're serious about attacks against this state. And the fourth feature, and this relates to something I mentioned in the last session, that the United States uses the military in every single instance that I can name as the ultimate guarantor of its interests and power, is the fourth feature of the national security state, is the military is the ultimate guardian, the ultimate protector of that security state, and that it sees itself engaged in a noble effort to preserve this nation against all of these enemies. We would be wrong to simply dismiss what I've said as nonsense, because what makes it most dangerous is that it's deeply internalized by many, many leaders in this country, including military leaders, and by many, many leaders of the military leaders of U.S. allies in Central Latin America. Now, it's within that framework that priests and nuns and lay workers get murdered. And let me just share with you a couple of quotations, and then I want to get you in small groups again. How many of you have heard of the Santa Fe Report, the Committee of Santa Fe? Not very many of you, a couple. Santa Fe Report was the Reagan administration's basically position paper on foreign policy, specifically as it related to Central Latin America, but also beyond. When I talked about the worldview last time, when some of you were here, that worldview came out of the Santa Fe Report. And I quote from it in this book, War Against the Poor. But here's one particular quote that helps explain again why so many church people are being murdered. The Santa Fe Report, again, which became the blueprint for the Reagan administration's policies in Central America, reads, says, U.S. foreign policy must begin to counter liberation theology as it is utilized in Latin America by the liberation theology clergy. Unfortunately, Marxist-Leninist forces have utilized the church as a political weapon against private property and productive capitalism by infiltrating the religious community with ideas that are less Christian than communist. Okay, here's the next quote. And this is a quote from someone that I met who had just returned from several years of living in Honduras as a refugee. It was a Salvadoran campesino, who was also a delegate of the word, a lay leader who would be doing Bible studies with communities in El Salvador. He said, by a miracle, I'm able to tell you the story of my grand crime for which they threatened me with death. They took my son, who was 18 years old, shot him, peeled off his skin, and cut him into pieces. Then they hung him from a cross in a tree. They cut his testicles off and put them in his mouth. They did this to warn me because I was a celebrator of the Word of God. That was my crime. We had to leave because they persecuted the whole land. Our crime is to be poor and ask for bread. Here the laws only favor the rich. However, the great majority of people are poor. Those who have jobs are exploited daily in the factories and on the farms. Without land, we cannot plant. There's no work. It brings more hunger and misery. And so we demonstrate. But to speak of justice is to be called a communist. To ask for bread is subversive. It is a war of extermination. It is a crime to be a Christian and to demand justice. That gives you a pretty clear statement of how the ideology of the national security state easily transforms into massive persecution of people who are working and organizing among the poor for social changes. One other piece I want to share with you, and if someone wants what's the word, where I got this from. I can give it to you later. The source, thank you. It comes from a National Catholic Reporter, National Catholic Reporter article. In 1987, the U.S. military organized what I believe is a yearly gathering of military leaders from most of the Central and Latin American countries. It's called the Conference of American Armies. At their 1987 meeting, they produced four top secret documents, several of which have been leaked to the religious leaders in Latin America, one of whom I heard speak. That was the first I'd heard of it, and then I came across this article in the National Catholic Reporter. They signed these documents, these leaders from United States, Argentina, Uruguay, Chile, Paraguay, Bolivia, Brazil, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, Venezuela, Panama, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. And what these documents do is they lay out that from the perspective of the United States and the elites, that the principal enemy confronting them is the church. That the principal enemy confronting them is liberation theology, which they see as a tool of international communism. I mean, that's the missing link in any, almost any conversation I've heard of the Jesuits' murders, is that it's linked fundamentally to an ideology that the United States has actively constructed, actively supported by increasing the power of militaries throughout the region, etc. Now, let me just end my little piece of this by sharing with you why I believe the Jesuits were murdered in El Salvador at the moment that they were murdered. The Jesuits who I had the good fortune of meeting and whose, they were probably the most respected, the Central American University in El Salvador is probably the highest respected university, certainly in Central America, maybe in Latin America. Their voices were incredibly articulate and powerful, both in and outside of the country. They were killed for basically three or four reasons. One, because they supported this liberating theology. They didn't accept it uncritically. It's not that they never had criticisms of these base groups that were reflecting upon theology and taking their action, but they supported this liberating theology and were strong defenders of the right of the dignity of the people to do that. A second reason they were murdered is that they said that the roots of the crisis throughout Central America and the two-thirds world and certainly El Salvador had very little to do with East-West relationships, had very little to do with communism, and had everything to do with social injustice. The roots of the crisis had to do with the tremendous inequality that I've talked about in the last couple of sessions. The third reason that they were murdered is that they promoted a negotiated settlement in El Salvador. They said the only way to resolve the crisis in El Salvador is through negotiations. And I've been an observer and visited El Salvador over the last 7 or 8 years. And the one thing the United States has been absolutely committed to making sure would never happen is a negotiated solution. And so they were clearly articulated or named as enemies of the United States because the U.S. is committed to a non-negotiated solution, or in using negotiations, using that term so loosely that it means almost nothing. And the fourth reason that they were killed is because they named the United States policy as either a or the principal obstacle to peace in El Salvador. They said over and over again, the ongoing funding by the United States makes negotiations impossible because when the military is being enriched by this war, why does it have any incentive at all to negotiate when the United States demonstrates its capacity. Now, I'm not suggesting that the U.S. Embassy ordered the murder of the Jesuits, although that may be true. Several priests, friends of mine, who were forced to leave the country in the aftermath of one priest friend and another Lutheran church worker, who were forced to leave the country after the murder of the Jesuits because they received death threats, believe that their death threats came directly from the U.S. Embassy. I will tell you that. But I'm not saying in this case that I know that the U.S. government ordered the murder of these Jesuits. That may be true. But whether that's true or not, what I'm suggesting is that this entire strategy of warfare called low-intensity conflict, the naming of the church as enemy, the building up of the militaries, it was an elite U.S.-trained battalion that murdered the Jesuits. It's elite U.S.-trained battalions in El Salvador that are carrying out most of the human rights violations. There's incredible amounts of evidence of U.S. involvement in training of death squads in El Salvador, for example. Now, what I want to do is give you some time. Now, we'll take... let's take... at least 10 minutes. And I want you to identify these things. What, those of you who have been here for the 3 days, or those of you who have been here today, what is most disturbing to you about the analysis and stories I'm sharing? Secondly, what questions does it raise for you? And thirdly, what are some appropriate responses that come to you as you hear about this? How, If what I'm saying is at all accurate, what does that mean for our lives and for priorities for our work? Thank you for writing those up. So the most disturbing questions that emerge and some tentative responses that you're thinking about. And I realize that some of you may be most upset by the fact that this idiot has dared to claim that the United States is promoting governments that kill priests. That's fine, name that. But for others of you, the discomfort may lie elsewhere. Okay, so take 10 minutes so we have a little time to report back. The third one is, what are some initial responses that you think? If this analysis is all correct, what does it mean for how we live? As we pull back together, let me just announce to people that we do have to be out of here pretty much on time because there's another class starting. But a couple of things. One, for me, the best way to learn is experientially to learn. And I brought some brochures from the Oxford College program that has 2-week intensive educational learning experiences in places like Central America. And there's examples of some of their semester programs, 2-week trips, as well as a general brochure. If anybody wants one of those, pick them up, if you could, immediately after, because I'm going to have to race and take the kids so that Sarah can do the...
Who funded that program?
Who funds the program? Oxford College, partially, and then what people pay to go on the trips. It's not rubles. And then second thing that I'll say is, how many people are planning on coming to the session tomorrow? I think it's at 6 o'clock or something.
Is mine
in the morning?
Yours is at 10:45.
Oh, okay. Mine's at 10:40. Okay, at 10:45. Okay, let me just ask, how many of you would appreciate, instead of me going into the new topic of democracy, if we just took more time to process some of what we'll lift up that came out of your small groups? And if we get half and half, then I'll have to decide it. How many people would appreciate some conversation time? I'll do a little bit of the other, but I would just allow a bigger block of time for conversation. How many would rather have a bigger block of time for conversation and a smaller block of time for more input? Only a couple people. How many people want the full input and then you'll process it on your own? Okay, all right, that seems to be the... Okay, now let's just hear, again, we've got just a few minutes, but I'd like to hear back, what were some of, just real quickly, brainstorm, what's most disturbing?
Well,
throw it up, throw them out.
Our families have marginalized us.
Families marginalize us when we try to talk about this. What else?
Government lying to us.
Government's lying to us.
Also, before what's happening in Central America ends up happening in this country.
Yeah, that's one of my big concerns. Is that how long? And people in Central America who really care about us are saying, you're naive to believe that you can allow your country to do what it's doing to us without it taking shape at home at some point. I think it's a very legitimate concern. Anybody else? Yeah.
My personal sort of compliance, because I happen to agree with you, but I don't really do much about it.
Okay, well, let's move on so we got a little time to talk about responses. How about, what are some questions that emerge out of this?
Why doesn't the Secretary of Defense speak up? And what is our situation with Mexico like this?
I'd say the Secretary of Defense doesn't speak out about this because he's key to designing the strategy of keeping the warfare invisible to us. In terms of Mexico, I'm not sure what I'd say about that. What are some others?
Yeah, how can we check up on your reports? How can we have another source of information?
Well, I would say one would be to take a look at the sources that I use in the book itself and evaluate those for yourself. And the other is, I mean, do what I do, and that's I try to read everything from all kinds of different sides, including what the military itself has to say, and I would encourage you to do that. And then this question came up before, and it's kind of related. I think we get bombarded. This is in no way a balanced view, because to have a balanced view, I would get 20 years with each of you, and we would talk about these issues, because we have been so socialized and ingrained in another thing, in other sides of this, that I can't begin to pull the scales off of my own eyes in a short period of time, let alone yours. But I would suggest three or four publications that I find helpful. And someone asked me about that last time. I know not everybody, some people are leaving, so I'll just mention these. From a religious perspective, one is Sojourners Magazine. If you don't get that, I'm sure that they have copies here in the Resource Center, and you can look at it. It's a good one. A weekly newspaper, In These Times, comes out of Chicago. You can probably find it at a local library. You could ask them to order it, or they could at least get the address for you. In These Times, it's called. Another weekly that's fairly good is The Nation, another weekly newspaper. The National Catholic Reporter, if you're looking at newspapers, oftentimes will carry, at least has reasonably good coverage on some of the issues we've been talking about. On a more secular level, those newspapers, some of them are secular, but there's a magazine called Z Magazine, Zeta, Z-E-T-A, but it just goes by Z Magazine. It's produced, I think, out of Boston or Massachusetts, but again, you could find it at a library. And then, I don't subscribe to this, but whenever I see it, it seems very good, is The New Internationalist, is another good publication on some of these issues. Other questions that emerge?
Well, a question that came up in our group was, now that we're kind of trying to be friends with Gorbachev and the communists, there's like good communists and bad communists, mm-hmm. but we're trying to make them into good communists. What's going to be the excuse for doing this if we can't use that communist threat anymore?
Regional and local communists. We've still got Cuba.
So they're going to be the bad guys.
Still got the Sandinistas. Still got the FMLN, whatever group it is, you can label them in that way. Second, the drug war. Third, terrorism, which is really ironic in light of what I talked about last time. Those are the main ones. As I said, and I said it halfway jokingly, the U.S. military is desperately searching, the military-industrial complex in this country is desperately searching for enemies to justify its presence. And what's interesting, and I don't have time to go into this, but I'll just mention it, is that the U.S. military has been very, very reluctant to move in the direction of low-intensity conflict. I mean, of a scaled-down specific force, and because it's not as powerful, it doesn't involve as much money. And the U.S. Congress, in some ways, has been leaders in almost forcing the military to move in this direction. Not because the military doesn't like some of this happening, but because it doesn't command the same kind of resources. And one of the reasons that we have, this is what I'll talk about next time, the tremendous impetus for covert illegal activities has been the reluctance of the military and some other sectors to you know, shift things in a legal way, or not even in a legal way, but to shift things in their own bureaucracies to be able to wage this war utilizing just our own military forces. That's why so much of it is being done by the CIA, by former CIA operatives in alliances with drug runners and cocaine dealers and all these people. So we'll come back to that. And I don't want to lose this, but next time I want to come back to the question of responses, because for me there are lots of responses, but they involve different kinds of costs for us and different kinds of opportunities. So we've got to stop. Thanks, and I hope most of you will be back.